Jewel Harrington. I'm a history professor, and I also work in the provost office.
Mayor Richard
Ferris. I have the great pleasure and privilege to introduce our panel today on the topic American Diplomacy, Current and Future Importance. And I have very, very brief introductions to our three panelists. They're all distinguished men that I could go on for at length, but I will keep it brief so you hear more from them. Ambassador Brian Carlson is one of the State Department's most experienced public diplomacy specialists. He's a career minister who's been posted to Spain, England, Norway, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, Venezuela, and most recently, Latvia. He has served as an indispensable leader in the political, economic, and social transformation of post-Soviet Eastern Europe. Ambassador Carlson has also been a tireless builder of cultural and other bridges between the United States and various countries in Eastern and Western Europe, including his 2000 appointment by President Clinton as co-producer of the White House Conference on Culture and Diplomacy. He recently ended 36 years in the Foreign Service and is now in private business in the Washington, D.C. area. More important than any of this, Brian Carlson and his wife, Marcia, are 1969 graduates of Vanderbilt. Ambassador Jim Sasser is a native of Memphis, Tennessee. I will tell you up front that he too had the wisdom to be a Vanderbilt alumnus twice, from the College of Arts and Science in 1958, from the law school in 1961. After several years in private practice as an attorney, Jim Sasser was elected as U.S. Senator of Tennessee. He served for 18 years, from 1977 to 1995, and his posts within that august body included chairman of the Budget Committee, as well as membership in several key subcommittees, including the Military Construction Subcommittee of the Committee of Appropriations, and the Subcommittee on International Finance and Monetary Policy of the Senate Banking Committee. Upon completion of his service in the Senate, Sasser was appointed U.S. Ambassador to China, where he represented our country with great distinction from 1995 to 1999. And he now resides in Washington, D.C. Am I right?
More or less.
More or less. Less today. John Siegenthaler is sadly not an alumnus of Vanderbilt, but he is a native of Nashville, who is widely known and respected around the university, Nashville, and the nation. A former president of the American Society of Newspaper Editors, Siegenthaler served for 43 years as an award-winning journalist at the Tennessean, where he acted as writer, editor, publisher, CEO, and since his retirement in 1991, chairman emeritus. In that same year, he founded the First Amendment Center, which now has offices at Vanderbilt and in Arlington, Virginia. Throughout his career, John Siegenthaler has been a very active proponent of civil rights and First Amendment protection, and his advice and service have been sought by several presidential administrations, including his most recent participation in the Constitution Project on Liberty and Security, created after the September 11th tragedies in New York and Washington. He has recently published a biography on James K. Polk. As a historian, I approve that. And he also hosts the PBS Weekly Book Review program, which I'm sure most of our audience knows, A Word on Words. Today, he will be serving as moderator to our discussion on the topic, American Diplomacy, Current and Future Importance.
Thank you very much, Joel, and thank all of you for coming. And my particular thanks to Ambassador Carlson and Senator Sasser, Ambassador Sasser. And it's very great honor for me to moderate discussion with these two very distinguished public servants. And the subject, as you know, and the subject that brought you here for their discussion, has to do with the role of the United States in world diplomacy, both, as you heard from Joel, have unique perspectives. Brian Carlson, a career diplomat whose service across Europe, culminating with his ambassadorship in Latvia, gives us one perspective. Senator Sasser, while in the Senate, of course, constantly had his finger on the pulse of the nation's posture in world affairs, and subsequently served in China during those 4 years, sometimes for very difficult years. I thought we'd begin by asking you both simply to analyze this nation's, your view of this nation's present position in international affairs. How are we viewed around the world? How are we seen to the extent that you can evaluate it across Europe, Ambassador Carlson, and Senator Sasser across the Pacific Rim, and in China? And Brian, if you would lead off,
like
we'll let Jim react, and then after I exhaust my shallow questions, I'll go to the audience for more depth.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great honor for me to be here at this table with John Siegenthaler, who I just reminded, well, I didn't remind him because he never realized it, but I actually worked for him at one point because
when I
was at Vanderbilt, I was bent on a career in journalism, and so I was trying some stringing and freelance work, and some of it included the Tennessean. The State Department made me I wouldn't say a better offer, but certainly it paid more steadily.
I don't doubt that.
And that's no fault of the Tennesseans. And Ambassador Sasser, I remember most particularly because I was in Washington on the end of some conference calls and discussions. Some of you may remember that while he was ambassador in China, we conducted one of our major public diplomacy operations when we put a bomb down the chimney of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, thereby creating for Ambassador Sasser a major problem to deal with, if I remember right.
A physical threat, among other problems.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, I was going to make a couple of comments on, it seems to me that one of the primary aspects of American presence abroad and America's diplomacy abroad and our foreign policy today that we need to focus on and think about what to do about it is the question of our image, how we are perceived, and anti-Americanism, if such a thing really does exist. I would start out by suggesting that I, at least for my purposes, I've always defined anti-Americanism as distinctive from those who disagree with our policies because they have some disagreement with the policy, but rather that's that instinctive across-the-board rejection of everything American because of some sort of prejudicial stance and so forth, and often an unreasoning sort of rejection of our position. There's nothing new about it. I would remind you that Alexis de Tocqueville, when he wrote his book on democracy in America, was actually swimming against the tide. In those days, in 18th century Europe, the general discussion was that the Americans were a bunch of thankless cultural boors who simply didn't understand, and their crazy ideas of representational democracy and individual freedoms had no chance of ever succeeding over the traditional way of handling things through nobility and privilege by birthright and that kind of an approach. And certainly, I mean, there's been a stream of this kind of thinking throughout in World War II. Even some of our closest allies that we were working with, the British, used to make comments about the American GIs being overpaid, oversexed, and over here. And I have no doubt that the populations of post-war Germany and Japan probably didn't have entirely fond feelings towards the Americans who had just bombed their countryside into smithereens, as Joel was and I were just talking about the destruction of World War II in Germany. But I would suggest that what we did there that made a difference was the Marshall Plan. We didn't just talk about the future that we intended. We did something about it. We committed ourselves to what would today be a $13 billion I think it was in those days, the $13 billion total program of economic and democratic reconstruction in Europe that made a difference and quickly turned, I think, any truly deeply anti-American sentiments around. I think there are some stereotypes that we have to deal with, and I'm only going to list a few of these and then let Ambassador Sasser talk, and then we'll come back to what we might do about it. But I think there are a couple of stereotypes out there, at least in Europe, about Americans that I would toss out is, I think, being amazingly prevalent. I've certainly dealt with them over my career. One is that America is a country ruled by money. There is no value in America that is more important, not family, not religion, not philosophy, that is more important than money. Money governs America. This is believed widely in many parts of the world. Another is that America is a country beset by poverty and inequality. People come back from trips and talk about the homeless in our streets and so forth, and they simply believe that there is no, the European term for it is social solidarity. There is no social solidarity in America, that's lacking here. Another thing they cannot quite fathom is the violence and the guns in America. It's not common in most countries in Europe, and they simply do not understand why we look upon guns the way we do, why we have laws. My own state of Virginia has a concealed weapons law, which allows me, if I chose, to carry a concealed weapon all the time. Many of them think we're naively religious, that we do ascribe to and make decisions on the basis of a religion that is often driven by television evangelists and by a moralistic tone that's unthinking. And, of course, there's the general idea that America has no culture other than that which Hollywood and television put out, and that there's no culture to be respected in America. And then most of them confirm all the above when they look at our political process and they find that we elect people that they would not elect. This doesn't just come in recent times. I mean, it goes back to the amazement that a salesman such as Harry Truman could get elected. But it goes on through to peanut farmers from Georgia and actors from California, a bumpkin from Arkansas who left all the European leaders standing on the White House lawn for hours in his first encounter with most of his counterparts, and on, of course, to the present cowboy oilman, George Bush, and there's simply that serves as a confirmation to many Europeans and many others in other parts of the world of what's wrong or why they don't respect America. Having tossed that out, let me turn to John.
I'm delighted to see we have a standing room only crowd. Jim Sasson said as he walked in, this looks like one of my rallies when I was running for the Senate.
There are a lot of vacant seats at that time.
There are not many left, and there are two sides who are standing in the rear. But you've made it a standing room crowd. Your father thanks you, and I do too.
Yeah.
Jim.
Well, Joe Nye, the dean of the Kennedy School at Harvard, is very fond of talking about hard power and soft power. The United States, I think, as far as hard power is concerned, which is defined primarily as military potential, unquestionably leads the world. With regard to our soft power, and that revolves around our moral leadership, the admiration that the rest of the world has for our policies, our culture, et cetera, is probably today at its lowest ebb since the Vietnam War. It's difficult for me, for example, to talk to my Chinese friends anymore about human rights. I used to talk quite a bit when I was in China about human rights, speak to the leadership there about human rights, and tell them privately and confidentially if they were ever to be fully accepted and fully respected in the world as a country, they were going to have to move in the direction of adopting basic policies that respected the rights of individuals in their persons and their property. It's difficult to talk about that now in the face of the scandals that are coming out of Abu Ghraib prison, what's happening in Guantanamo, our own Congress debating whether or not torture is something that can be accepted by the American military, with our own vice president at least if the newspapers are to be believed, and John, I still do naively believe most of them, if they're still to be believed, our vice president is very much in favor of allowing our military to use sort of extra legal means to extort confessions and information from others. So our soft power, I think, is at a very, very low ebb. Ambassador Carlson spoke a moment ago about how the United States was accepted in Europe and even in Japan after the Second World War. And there, I think, by the generosity of the American people with the Marshall Plan and by the simple goodwill exuded by American military forces in Germany and in other areas of Europe, American soft power very quickly, I think, recovered. And we became, I think, admired quite a bit. Now, in China at the present time, and that's what I'm most familiar with, the Chinese people still are very friendly as far as individual Americans are concerned. But they're very anti-American as far as the policies of our government are concerned. They view us as being hegemons who want to control not only our destiny, but the destiny of the other countries of the world. And this has the effect of stoking nationalism in China and stoking an anti-Americanism towards our government. The Chinese admire our technology enormously. Every Chinese family wants to send their children to school at American university. English is the language of upward social and economic mobility in China. Things are fine except for the policy of the United States government, which is generally disliked and detested at the local level in China. So there is an anti-Americanism, I think, around the world. It's an anti-Americanism, though, that's directed not at the American people so much, in my view, as it is at the American government. Let's just take an example. A few months ago, the President of the United States journeyed to London, England, for a meeting with the Prime Minister there. Now, this is our closest ally in the world. We fought three wars beside the British in the 20th century and are fighting one beside the British in Iraq today. But the President of the United States had to come in and out of London like a thief in the night. He could not be subjected to the kind of reception that he would have gotten by the British people. The President of the United States goes to South America. Tens of thousands turn out to demonstrate against the president and against the policies of our government. It would be that way, I would venture to say, Ambassador Carlson, in France perhaps, in Germany, in some of our closest allies around the world. The Chancellor of Germany ran for re-election on an anti-American ticket just a short time ago, and that saved his political bacon in the election just before this one. The president of South Korea, in the last election in South Korea, bear in mind there would be no South Korea except for the sacrifice of about 60,000 American lives in 1951 and 1952. And we built there, with the help of the Koreans, an economic democracy. The president of South Korea ran for re-election on an anti-American ticket and was elected. Now, I think that gives you some idea where the American, where American diplomacy stands on a worldwide basis vis-a-vis soft power. And just a reading of a worldwide poll done by the Pew Charitable Trust last year, I think, would totally reinforce that when you see the negative impression that is almost worldwide with regard to American policy. Interestingly enough, we came out probably better in Iran than we did anywhere in Western Europe. So that gives you some idea of where I think we are now, and the necessity, I think, for a vigorous campaign of public diplomacy and a vigorous campaign of trying to reestablish the moral leadership and the moral credentials of the United States around the world.
Let me just pose a question as it relates to cause. I went back and found a CBS report dated March 2003. At that time, the president had given Saddam Hussein an ultimatum: step down in 48 hours or there would be war. And before there was war, the reaction from the German chancellor, from the French president, from the Vatican, from China, from Indonesia, from New Zealand, and elsewhere was extremely negative. And this report only Prime Minister Howard in Australia offered support for what was contemplated by the United States and the British. Over the years, administration in, administration out, without identifying partisan administrations, our attitudes in the world have ebbed and flowed, and I've been in Europe when, at an earlier time when there was anti-American feeling, I've been in Japan when there was anti-American feeling. How much of this current, almost worldwide opposition, and the president as we speak is on his way to South Korea, how much of it relates directly to the decision to go to war, and if you want to respond to that, how this war is different from others, some of which were very unpopular too, as Senator Sasser says, the war with Vietnam divided this country. Uniquely, this war does not seem to divide along partisan lines. I find Democrats as supportive of the war at this point as Republicans are.
I agree with you. I think, first of all, there is sort of a pendulum effect in public affairs and in public diplomacy and in America's image abroad. I certainly, too, have lived through the time when, we blocked a steel, what was it, no, oil pipeline, I guess it was, with Russia and Europe, and caused all kinds of, disgust with the United States, and the early days of the Reagan administration were no fun to be abroad representing the United States because there was general, rejection of our policies and so on. And ditto for the early days of the Clinton administration. I mean, the Europeans were absolutely dismissive and disgusted with this guy who didn't care much about foreign policy. If you remember, it's the economy, stupid. Yeah, I've been through that, and I see it go up and down. And I think, frankly, I mean, one of the things that would restore our standing enormously would be, I don't know how you do this, but if there were some sort of success in the Middle East, either Israel-Palestine or in Iraq, but either one would do a lot. You saw the bounce, frankly, in sort of our image and our ratings and so forth after the elections last January in Iraq, which looked like actually something was moving forward. Much of the world loves a winner, and I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think we have to be honest and recognize the fact that Madeleine Albright used to say that the United States is the essential nation. We are the indispensable nation, the indispensable nation. And the fact is that around the world, we are the most influential nation on earth. And foreigners watch our elections, watch our domestic politics like we do. It's amazing how you can go into foreign countries and start talking to people, and they know about our Senate and the makeup and the balance and who's going on which side and what's going on in American domestic politics, even between elections. And they often regret that they can't vote in American elections. But the fact is that, if we start consuming a little more oil or something, the prices go up in Europe and they go up around the world. If the dot-coms in America bust, the dot-coms in Tel Aviv bust, and so on around the world. What we do makes a tremendous difference. And secondly, I'd say we do want to change the world. We've long had a certain missionary kind of flavor to our foreign policy and to our relation with other countries. And if anything, it's probably gotten stronger recently. You probably helped author some of Kennedy's speeches, which talked about this. You have the Marshall Plan, as I referred to. Even President Bush's speeches in his 2005 State of the Union address talked about this question of freedom and unfreedom, and it is America's mission to spread democracy around the world. I think we engage in sort of a democratic realism usually on this, and at our best we engage in a democratic realism. That is, we will always stand on the side of freedom and always stand for the side of democracy and so forth, but Americans are usually reluctant to commit our troops to it. And in the case that you referred to of Iraq, we were, I think our patience had been exhausted after all the Clinton administration dealt with Saddam, actually the first Bush administration dealt with Saddam Hussein, the Clinton administration dealt with him throughout, and there was a sense that we had to push for some action. I think, frankly, our diplomacy failed. We failed to get our allies on board on this, at least as much as we should have. And when we finally struck out more or less unilaterally, it cost us a lot in public support around the world, and we're still paying that price.
Do you see that the same way, Jim?
Yes, I do. I think that perhaps one difference with the war in Iraq was I viewed what happened in Iraq as a reversal of over a century of American foreign policy. Iraq was the first time that an American president had announced the doctrine that we had the right to wage a preemptive war, that we had the right to determine when our vital interests were affected adversely, and if we, and only we, determined that, then we had the right to go to war to protect that. Now, heretofore, I think American diplomacy and American foreign policy had been built on a multilateralism, beginning with Woodrow Wilson and the League of Nations. And the League of Nations was founded, and the United Nations as well, to prevent countries, as I understand it, Ambassador, from waging preemptive war. After all, Hitler said he needed living space, so they go into Czechoslovakia or Poland. Nations can trump up reasons for going to war. And the American view has always been that there should be no such thing as a preemptive war. Well, we reversed that policy in going into Iraq. And I think the rest of the world saw that as a bully determining that they were going to do what they want to do, and the rest of the world be damned. And I, in my own view, I think that's one thing that's so poisoned the world against us at the present time. I think that Brian is right. If we could have a success, and the greatest success would be if we could bring peace and stability and some degree of justice to the Palestinian-Israeli question, then I think that would go a long way to reestablishing us as the moral leader of the world. I think in most places, in Europe, rightly or wrongly, and certainly in the Middle East, we're viewed as not being even-handed in the Israeli-Palestinian question, and I think that's another thing that bothers us. If I could just say this, we've always, and Brian is right, we've always had sort of a missionary zeal that's been an ingredient in our policy, foreign policy or whatever. At first it was actually missionaries who were going to bring religion to the Native Americans as we took their land away from them. And then beginning early in this century and with Woodrow Wilson, it was to bring democracy to the world. The First World War and our entry into it was the war to end all wars. Franklin Roosevelt's United Nations was an effort to make sure that we would have no more authoritarian dictators who would engage in a preemptive war. We wanted to bring democracy and economic equality to Western Europe and to Japan, and in large measure, we did that. Now we talk about human rights, but it has a hollow ring, I think, to the rest of the world.
If you look at, let's just take that term, missionary zeal, for a moment. Is there a different spin on the term now that we are at war with extremists in the Muslim world? Twice in the last 72 hours, I have seen television reports and read news reports in which some spokesman for Muslim extremist terrorists have used the word crusader. It does strike me that the traditional missionary zeal with which we sought to democratize the those countries that rejected democracy, I mean, for the most part, it was rhetoric more than action. Now it seems to me we are viewed as Christian crusaders, by Muslim extremists as Christian crusaders, and maybe by some Muslim moderates as Christian crusaders, whose bombs and weapons really have a second underlying goal beyond our effort to establish a viable government in Iraq. Am I going too far with that suggestion?
No, I think there is something to it. I've recently read a couple of different studies. There's a Professor Polk, I guess his name is, who's recently come out with a book. He has actually studied the lives of every suicide bomber since 1984, and he has analyzed everything that could be found out about what these people thought and what they said and what they wrote before they died and so forth. And the amazing unifying factor that he finds in all of them is not a rejection of capitalism or a rejection of America per se, but it is a frustration born of having foreign troops in their countries, in what is considered the holy land or the sacred land of Islam and so forth. Now, I don't think that ever excuses terrorism, but I find it interesting that he, at least in this rather exhaustive analysis, and there have been some others who have done some work like this, keep finding that this is the single thing that runs throughout a lot of the Islamic terrorism, is it's the objection, and it's a frustration built out of the fact that there's nothing else they can do about it. No amount of talking or whatever will get our troops out of there, you know. So the only thing they feel that they can do, they are powerless otherwise. It's a frustration, maybe there's another word, but that causes them to react this way. I think then you distinguish that from some of our allies and traditional friends and so forth, and I compare them to, we've all seen the movies about the Old West and everybody's gathered in the saloon, you know. Well, except now the situation is a little different. There's only one guy in the saloon who has a six gun. So guess what? Everybody votes that we ban six guns, you know, and no more gunplay. We are the only nation can reach out around the world, any part of the world, within half an hour and strike lethally at another country. We have aircraft carriers, we have missiles, and so forth. Nobody else has the military power that we do. Guess what? They're all scared of it, and they would like to put some restraints on it, whether it's called the United Nations or international law or whatever. And so when we say we don't want to be restrained or we won't be restrained, it provokes, maybe more frustration, certainly disagreement.
Let me just extend it, Sandra, with you. It strikes me that this is a unique war and a unique international situation for yet another reason. In past wars, there were always geographic boundaries and a sense of nationalism where the enemy was concerned. In this war, it's impossible to tell who's an Iraqi, who's an Iranian, who's a Saudi, who's a Jordanian. There is no national our geographic boundary to define or describe or identify the enemy. How in such a war is a nation to sue for peace?
Well, clearly you don't sue for peace in the traditional way because there's nobody to sue for peace with. And this war is unique to us, but you know, the British were in Iraq in the 1920s, and there's a cemetery there, I'm told, with 20,000 British soldiers in it, most of them Empire troops, not Brits from India or other places. But they had their problems with the Arabs and others at that time. I think in this particular instance, it's difficult to know how this thing can be brought to a conclusion. And it's certainly difficult to know how it can be brought to a conclusion in such a way that it's not damaging to American interest and not damaging to the region. In other words, we've created such a mess. It's sort of like the old baseball story about the fellow who was playing shortstop and had three or four hits go right between his legs, and the coach took him out and put another shortstop in, and the second thing, this happened with the second shortstop, and the second shortstop said, well, the first shortstop has messed up this position so badly nobody can play it. Well, that's kind of the way we are in Iraq. It's in such a terrible mess that you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you get out, then the place could very well fall off into civil war. It probably is in a civil war already, but it could take the place of Afghanistan as the training area for future terrorists. If you stay there, then, as Ambassador Carlson said, one of the these studies of terrorism indicate that what causes the suicide bombers are simply the presence of Westerners in an area where the Arab fundamentalists think they should not be. And so if you stay there, then you continue to incur casualties and continue to engender violence that not only does us damage, but does damage to the native Iraqis. My own sense is, John, you can't sue for peace. But at some point, I think you have to lay down a marker and say, as of such and such a date, we are going to withdraw our forces from Iraq and let the chips fall where they may. Now, I think that would encourage Iraqis who really want to have some sort of stable, partially democratic government, or a government that at least guarantees some basic human rights, those Iraqis to stand up and try to take things in their own hands. And if they don't, then I don't know that we can continue to stay there indefinitely. I was talking to some old friends who'd been in Vietnam, and they were telling me that the best thing that happened was when we told the Vietnamese we were getting out, and that they couldn't count on us to save their bacon anymore. And then they saw the Vietnamese troops that they'd been fighting with alongside, and particularly the Vietnamese officer corps, start pulling together and really doing a workmanlike job. And of course, they ultimately lost, but some say that's not their fault, that we simply cut off the materials and coming to them when the Congress got the appropriations for them. But in any case, to answer your question briefly, there's nobody to sue for peace with, so you either have to fish or cut bait.
You know, I have a long list of shallow questions to continue those I've asked. My guess is that there is more depth in the audience than in this seat. And so I'm going to ask you, if you have questions, to raise your hand. It's more fun if you identify yourself. Yes.
I'm Bill Schwartz. I'm a retired international businessman and academic. And my question is really quite shallow. I'm going to try and be succinct, but I struggle with these. Over the last 10 years or so, I've watched a lot of international Chinese economic development. Okay? And it seems to me that as long as Americans have plenty of money to buy imported goods, I don't see it slowing well. I don't see a stop in that. As long as the Chinese can produce quality, very inexpensive goods, that they will dominate industries that they had not previously dominated. Furniture probably is a really good example right now. So the question then becomes, do we pursue an economically conservative viewpoint where we say that they were capitalists, let the chips fall where they may, or do we engage in some protracted legislative and administrative process to present barriers to the Chinese?
Well, since that deals with China, I guess that's directed to me. I mean, I think the horse is already out of the barn on the question of how you deal with China and other of these developing nations with very low wage rates. I mean, China is now a member of the World Trade Organization. The United States...
Can I just interrupt you for a second? In your opinion, is that inappropriate?
Yes, I think it probably was for a lot of reasons. The Chinese are pretty good about, if you'll let them be part of making the rules, they're pretty good at adhering to the rules. And what the World Trade Organization, or letting them in the WTO, does, it goes a long way towards establishing a more level playing field for American products coming into China or American businesses doing business in China. I mean, the Chinese were already had open and complete and almost total access to our markets and everything except maybe some needle goods or fabrics. But I think in the long run and in the short run, it certainly was the thing to do. But the problem we Americans have, we have been the leading proponent now, I guess, since the Second World War, Ambassador Kramer, that for globalization and free trade. I mean, we and the British are the original free traders, and we learned it from the British. Now, nobody else in the rest of the world, in my view, is really that interested in free trade, but we've espoused it all over the world, and we've done pretty well with it. Now, globalization is here, and I don't know of anything that can be done about it. As far as China is concerned, I think we've got to concentrate more on forcing them or persuading them or manufacturing things that are more attractive to them to import. I think also you're going to see opening up, and it already is in China, an enormous domestic market. I mean, there are 1.3 or 4 billion people there, and there are insatiable demands almost in that domestic market. They've gone from being a nation on bicycles a few years ago, now to where they're going to be the second or third largest automobile market in the world, either this year or next year. I mean, Volkswagen sells more cars in China than they do in the United States. And every automobile manufacturer almost in the world, including BMW and Mercedes, are in China assembling automobiles. So as that domestic market opens up, hopefully it's going to absorb more of these goods. Hopefully wage rates are going to come up, and the Chinese will be, other nations will be more competitive with the Chinese. The Chinese are not just hollowing out some of our industries. It's happening in Japan. It's happening in Taiwan. It's happening all over the world. And I think the real challenge for Western civilization and for developed industrial nations all over the world is how do we absorb these enormous cheap labor pools that measure into the billions in China and India and still maintain our own economic structures and still maintain our own social safety nets here and still maintain our own political stability. I mean, you're seeing all over Europe extraordinarily high unemployment rates that continue. you're seeing here, not low low unemployment rates, but you're seeing many, many marginal, low-paying jobs, people who are underemployed or at least underpaid. So I see that as the real challenge for us in the coming decades. How do you absorb these enormous cheap labor pools and still maintain our affluent societies?
Another question on the front row. How are you?
The reaction of the president in Latin America last week was embarrassing and frightening. What could we do to improve our relationship with Latin America other than a regime change in Washington? For example, could we normalize our relations with Cuba? Could we put some reins on free trade agreements with Latin American countries, or what else should we do?
Do you want to try that, Ambassador?
Well, I'm actually not that surprised by the reaction to the president last week in Latin America, because I've, I guess over the course of my career, I've advanced some 14 presidential foreign visits, and you always deal with protesters and so forth. And lately, it seems that it's the gathering event. I mean, it's like a WTO meeting or any of these economic fora that seem to also attract a certain core group of just, you know, radical protesters bent on causing anarchy and so forth, and then they are surrounded by some people who perhaps even believe, you know, more reasonable things. But so you've always got to deal with protesters. But I mean, there's no question it was not a successful trip for the president in that case. I think in the case of Latin America, frankly, our policy with Cuba has been wrong for years, because I think that the way we succeed is when we engage people. And when we work with them and we do things together, not when we isolate them. And much as I understand the impetus of those who would like to say that they don't want anything to do with a guy like Castro, the trouble is there are, 7-8 million more Cubans down there who aren't Castro, you know, and they're suffering. And we could probably have a lot more effect. I spent my career working on Eastern Europe, and I believe there we took the other tack. We engaged people, we stayed in touch, we worked with them. We brought the dissidents and the opposition leaders to the United States on, you know, scholarships and grants. We, you know, so that today they're our friends. They all speak English and everything else. In fact, that's the part of Europe that does support us the most. And I just came from Latvia, a country that supports us in Iraq. Interestingly, they did not make that decision, and they just renewed their mandate. Their troops are going to stay for another year. They didn't do it, however, because of weapons of mass destruction. They did it because they believe, based on their experience before World War II with Hitler, that a tyrant must be stopped before he kills again, so to speak, you know, before trouble begins. I think that we have to engage and deal with these countries as equals, as sovereign nations, not equals in terms of power or economic power or whatever, but as sovereign nations whose people have a right to make their own decisions. Mm-hmm.
Well, could I just amplify that just a little bit? On the question of, I'm interested in this because I've made a few trips to Cuba in the last year and a half, and I agree with the ambassador that our policy towards Cuba is absolutely wrongheaded, and I think if we opened up Cuba to trade and if we allowed free passage back and forth, I think the Castro regime might not last too much longer. I'm not sure that Fidel Castro really wants open trade with the United States, and certainly I'm not sure that he wants free travel back and forth, because of their economic problems there. He can blame those economic problems on us, and he does that very much. And now, as you'll see, they've cut off some of the tourist trade coming into Cuba. And he's got two new friends. One is China and the other is Venezuela. And so he's putting all of his eggs in the China and the Venezuelan basket. The Chinese, Cuba, I think, is the second or third largest nickel producer in the world. And the president of China has been down there, and they've agreed, I think, to buy all their nickel at world prices for the next 10 years. And the Chinese are investing a couple of $1 billion in building a nickel facility there. Chavez is giving him oil at cut rate prices and then just giving him some that he sells on the world market. And he sends to Venezuela physicians who do great work in the Venezuelan barrios with the poor of Venezuela. The scheme works like this. He sends physicians and other civil servants to Venezuela. The Venezuelans pay Castro, and the physicians in Venezuela, who are Cubans, get 40% of their salary. The Cuban government gets 60% of their salary, and they use that to help sustain the Cuban economy. But to answer the broader question, I think if we would quit viewing every socialist government that arises, South America, we have been the chief proponent of sort of unfettered capitalism in South America. And we've been the chief proponent of them taking some of this bitter IMF medicine over the years. And it's failed. Argentina had a financial collapse. And now they're moving back in the direction of socialism. I'm not talking about communism, I'm talking about social democratic governments. And we shouldn't view every social democratic government that arises there as automatically an enemy or view it with suspicion. These people have got the right to make their own decisions about what kind of government they have. And the question of Chavez in Venezuela, who's been sort of the focal point of the criticism of the United States, bear in mind that we tried to engaged to some extent in a coup d'etat to get him out. And he managed to survive and come back in. So what we need to do, in my view, Mr. Ambassador, is get those right-wingers that this administration has put in the State Department that enunciate our policy for south of the border, get them out and get some State Department professionals in there that understand the region and understand what's happening, and try to come up with a reasonable policy for South America.
You have a question? Yes, on the front row.
You've touched on the question. I came here for tonight for selfish reasons. I want to know, do I have to wait till Castro dies before I can go to Cuba? I have thought about going on some of these charitable missions that are sort of a sham, but they always booked up. I never get in on the one. I can go through Toronto, but now they're making moves to either prosecute or fine people who visit Cuba. But I get all kind of brochures from China. In fact, I was trying to reach China before while you were ambassador, and before the Chinese grew a lot taller than I am. But I didn't make it. But I'm trying to get there this winter, but I mean spring, because I understand it's pretty cold, but I would like to go to Cuba before having to outlive Castro, and I can't figure out what is the problem here. Why can't we crack that and go the route that you're talking about and win him over? The Chinese, you know, I still think of them as Red China, and until Nixon went there in 72, so I thought maybe we could send George Bush there and in 2009 and crap the solution. But we could all go down there and retire on our Social Security if we just work with Castro and smooth them a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you go to Costa Rica and retire your Social Security now. The architects of our Cuban policy are the Cuban immigrants who live in southern Florida. And it's really a money game and a vote game. I mean, they control enough votes down there to swing Florida one way or the other, and they make enormous political contributions. So that's what it's all about.
Well, in the 2004 presidential debates, John Kerry cited nuclear proliferation as the greatest threat to global stability, and George Bush agreed with that. And then several weeks ago, we had the president of Iran, which is currently trying to pursue nuclear weapons programs, saying that he would like to wipe Israel off the face of the map. So my question is, what do you feel that we need to do? Because clearly we can't allow the Iranian government to gain nuclear weapons.
Do you want to answer that?
Couple of thoughts on that. There are a lot of people who do believe that nonproliferation is absolutely the one thing we really must be worried about. And if Iran were to get nuclear weapons and so forth, the evidence is not entirely clear that that is what they are attempting to do, that they are trying to weaponize or get nuclear weapons, deliverable nuclear weapons. But clearly, if they were to do so, that would be a very scary thing for a lot of people around the globe. The rhetoric by the Iranian president was not new. It's been said by Iranians before, but not for a while, and not by the president, not in, you know, in such terms. He's an amateur, or he's new, and so forth. I think the votes or the judgment is still out on how hard to read that. Everybody cracked down on him, and I assume the Iranians got the message that that won't do. But the question of nuclear proliferation, if you look at countries like North Korea and some of these, they were called rogue states at one time, this genuinely is a serious problem. And, you know, it's amazing to me. I mean, we can be surprised, I guess, sometimes that our allies don't agree with this, but we can be amazed, I think I can be amazed, at the lack of willpower on the part of some of our European and other allies when it comes to dealing with this, because, good heavens, an Iranian missile will surely hit Germany before it hits us. I mean, you know, before they can do intercontinental, they're going to have to do continental. So I'm surprised that we cannot get better support for cracking down on Iran. But it's an argument over tactics, not over ends. Mm-hmm.
I realize that my final question is all the stand between our exercising our First Amendment right to a free drink, and we're going to have a reception after the show,
please.
And so I'll ask the final question, the first one calls for a general response. So the two of you agree, I think, that if not unprecedented, our position is at a very low ebb worldwide. We haven't talked about Africa. We haven't really talked about Australia, except to mention the support for the Commonwealth. And for Tony Blair's position. But if I could just ask each of you the impossible question. How do we get out of this? How do we change this? How can we, given the morass, I don't want to use the Vietnam quagmire metaphor, but how do we extricate ourselves and once more at least some of the world come to be respected, admired, perhaps not loved, but at least held in regard with respect?
Well, I guess a couple of thoughts. I graduated from Vanderbilt in history, and I remember sitting in Professor Marchant's class over in Neely Auditorium getting some world civilization training. And, you know, the discussion of mercantilism and things like that came up and all. I think this kind of goes back to the question asked by the gentleman back along the center aisle there. I think one of the things is we have to stick to our principles. And if we believe in free trade, and if we believe in free market economics, and if we believe that those vast, unseeable economic forces will eventually cause it to turn out for the good, then we have to engage in free trade with China and other countries around the world, and we have to stick to the free market doctrine and the doctrine of democracy. I simply don't think it will work to try and create trade structures or something that will, you know, keep certain parts of the world in backwardness or off our markets and so forth. It just won't work over the long term. And as Senator Ambassador Sasser said, when we can start selling to all those Chinese who are going to need to buy not only a new car, but a new refrigerator, a new computer, some new software for it, and so forth, you know, the American economy will profit from this. Secondly, maybe as an ancillary to that, it is important that we that we mean what we say, that we stand up for our values. You know, I worked a lot with Eastern Europe in my career, and the East Europeans, the people who were behind the Iron Curtain in the days of the Soviet Union, they didn't sort of all come joining the West after the Berlin Wall fell down just because we had the shiniest missiles or because we had videotape recorders or whatever. They came because of what we believe in. They came because we said we stood for freedom. We supported their dissidents. We supported the opposition leaders throughout all those long years. We managed to do both things. To go to Cuba, we managed to hold the governments at sort of arm's length and deal with the people and with the rising leaders of the next generation and so forth. I think we can do that again. But lastly, it's not just what you say. It's not just what, you know, people don't care what you say until they know that you care. And the point is that we need to engage in something other than warfare with countries around the world, like Iraq and others. What did we do in Western Europe after World War II? We bombed them to smithereens. There's no question about that in World War II. But afterwards, we offered them the hand of friendship, and we actually offered money and cooperation to rebuild industries. We offered free access to our markets. And we helped to build through investment and trade, not just government action, but also private action, our companies and so forth, our societies, our universities took in their people and so on. And that's what people remember. They don't remember, maybe some do, the bombing or whatever, but people remember what you do. And if you work together, if you engage seriously with people, that's what gets remembered. And that's what proves that your words have meaning.
Well, I think we're fortunate. I mean, U.S. Prestige and esteem around the world is at a very, very low ebb. But at the risk of sounding unduly partisan, and I am a partisan, but at the risk of sounding unduly partisan, we're fortunate in that much of this is personalized against our present president, George Bush. It's not directed so much at the U.S. government, and not directed, I think, very much at all at the American people. Now, when Bill Clinton left office, he was enormously popular in China. There's still noodle shops in China that have Bill Clinton's picture up there. And his visit there was for 10 days, and he just took the Chinese by storm, and the Chinese leadership opened up the media to him, and for the first time in the history of China, there was an open press conference and debate between the President of the United States and the President of China, in which the President of the United States asked the President of China on television and on radio, what about human rights in China? You know, what about the way you're treating your own people? He asked it in a very delicate, diplomatic way, but when he left office, we were enormously popular. Our president was enormously popular in China, and our government benefited from that popularity. And I dare say, Ambassador, from what I heard about Europe, I think Clinton was pretty popular there. And so much of this now is personalized on Bush. So I think once the administration, once we change administrations, I'm hopeful that some of it will diminish. But things we ought to do is move away from this unilateralism that this administration seems to have espoused and move back in the direction of multilateralism, and that is cooperation with our traditional allies in Europe and in Asia. And if we can't cooperate fully with them, at least appear to be cooperating. Secondly, I think if we would really devote all of our efforts to trying to resolve in an equitable fashion the Israeli-Palestinian question, that would rehabilitate us all over Europe and certainly go a long way to solving the hatred that's now directed against the United States in the Middle East and all through the Arab countries. And lastly, to be a positive force on the UN Security Council and try to work as much as possible through the Security Council, and not look as if we're the 990-pound gorilla that's ordering everybody else around, expecting everybody else to do our bidding. I think that's one way we can rehabilitate ourselves and take advantage of what I perceive, based on my experience in China, as positive good feelings toward the American people.
Well, I would like to express, Joel, on behalf of Vanderbilt University, and express personally my appreciation to these two distinguished public servants. You know, those who serve our country abroad do so at great sacrifice, great personal sacrifice. I think if you think of Ambassador Carlson and his spouse who was here, those years in Eastern Europe, so close to what was considered the enemy in a Cold War era, always there were pressures, always there were dangers. You think of Senator Sasse, whose spouse is here, those days in China, including, as Ambassador Carlson said, that moment when the explosion in Belfast threatened their physical safety. Think of China, hardly as our traditional friend. You realize what sacrifice really is for them and for their families and for all they've done for us and their presence here tonight. I ask you to join me in thanking them.